This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Really pleased and honored to have Professor Floyd Thomas with us this morning. The title of his lecture, the subject is Stand Up Jamrock Generation, Reflections on the Rastafari, Theology, Reggae Music, and the Politics of Postcolonial Jamaican Culture. Please join me in welcoming Floyd Thomas.
Well, good morning, one and all. I thank you all for coming out this morning. I especially want to extend my appreciation to Dave Perkins for arranging this series, as well as, once again, doing that kind of wonder-making power that only he can do by setting up this physical environment to match the sentiments of this series. I also want to thank friends, students, colleagues, friends I haven't met yet, for coming out this morning and not thinking of robbery to spend a little time talking about something that's near and dear to my heart. I also want to thank my colleague John McClure for being a tough act to follow. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to do my level best to bring the ruckus. Okay. And last but not least, I want to try and, in this kind of creative space, do something a little different, hopefully a little experimental, and try to unfold this presentation in three parts. And so, because the story that I'm telling or presenting to you all functions in three parts, first rooted in the classic work by Bob Marley, but then working a narrative line that breaks down and deconstructs the very same song in a number of different ways. And then towards the end, I'll explain why the power of the mashup has always been something paradoxical yet promising in my imagination. But let's begin with the beginning. Now, in many ways, Get Up, Stand Up is a pivotal song within the scope of Bob Marley's musical legacy to the world. As the first song on the group's sophomore album, The Burning Album, this song both musically and lyrically serves as a call to action that the group offers a more confrontational and militant tone than on their previous recordings, either by the Wailers or other reggae bands of the era. Whereas it's virtually impossible to forget the song's chorus, you know, and this is what you just heard, get up, stand up, stand up for your rights, get up, stand up, don't give up the fight. What most listeners fail to recognize that it's actually in the verses wherein Marley and his band, a longtime friend and collaborator, Peter Tosh, offer a scathing critique of organized religion as a means of mass domination and social oppression. Serving as a signature anthem for the Wailers, regardless of the rest of their playset, the band often made this the last song they played during each of their concert performances. This fact was made all the more bittersweet because Get Up, Stand Up was the very last song Marley ever performed live on stage at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on September 23rd, 1980. By May 1981, this prophet and poet of the post-colonial era would eventually lose his epic fight with cancer cells that spread throughout his body and ended his life prematurely at the age of 36. For these and other reasons that hopefully will be reflected in this presentation, Get Up, Stand Up is the quintessential Bob Marley song insofar as it epitomizes three movements, the three R's, if you will, that he will always be identified with, namely reggae music, the Rastafarian movement, and revolutionary action. When the style of African diasporic music known as Jamaican reggae became internationally popular from the late 1960s onward, virtually no performer in that genre matched the level of notoriety and success achieved by Bob Marley. While it might be a surprise to some, despite Bob Marley's rightful place in the high pantheon of giants in the history of reggae music, he's neither the sole inventor nor singular innovator of that genre. There's a list of many luminaries ranging from Desmond Dekker, Toots and the Maytals, Lee Scratch Perry, Jimmy Cliff, Black Uhuru, and Burning Spirit, just to name a few, who would have to be acknowledged in this regard. The reason that I choose to focus on Bob Marley is that, aside from being one of my all-time favorite musical heroes, I think his life and legacy offer wonderfully rich insights into the vagaries of post-colonial realities through an examination of how the three R's I just mentioned, reggae music, the Rastafarian movement, and revolutionary action, play themselves out in the life not only of Bob Marley, but beyond. Please note that I see the notion of beyond in this case to be multidimensional in nature. First, I want to explore how Bob Marley's life, faith, and music matched the ebb and flow of Jamaican politics and culture as it underwent the growing pains of its independence struggle from British colonial rule. Second, I want to address the ways in which Marley had to, like many artists who are also activists, safeguard his vision and voice as a prophet to ensure that his divinely inspired gifts could not only entertain, but also enlighten and ultimately empower those who needed it the most, the downtrodden masses being crushed by the weight of hegemonic oppression. Next, using Bob Marley's classic song, Get Up, Stand Up, as a sort of leitmotif, a shining thread running through the narrative, especially as it moves from its original version to how it's deconstructed and reconstituted in the hands of Marley's youngest son, Damien, also known as Junior Gong Marley, in response to a later, if not altogether new, phase of Jamaica's post-colonial reality. Finally, I want to take the chance to illustrate how a synthesis of the two generational perspectives might be the best hope for a way forward through the amorphous fog that pervades the current state of Jamaican politics. Throughout much of the, just to give you a brief kind of overview of what I'm talking about in terms of this thing known as the post-colonial, this post-colonial era, this post-colonial discourse and scholarship. Throughout much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, a huge portion of the globe and its inhabitants, ranging from Aruba to Zimbabwe, were colonized and controlled by Western imperial powers. Although Great Britain and France certainly had the most widespread colonial empires, a whole host of countries, ranging from Japan to Germany to the United States, oversaw lands outside their national borders and imposed military control and economic domination over those lands. When this network of empires and colonies largely crumbled after the Second World War, the inhabitants of the former colonial lands began to demand their liberation in political, economic, cultural, and spiritual terms. To think how rapidly the world has changed in a relatively brief period, it must be recalled that within a 20 or so year period from 1945 to 1965, the same period that gave rise to the southern phase of the civil rights movement in the United States, we also witnessed Gandhi's independence movement in the Indian subcontinent, the Maoist revolution in China, the founding of the modern state of Israel in 1948, the division of North and South Korea, the Vietnamese defeat of the French military forces at Dien Bien Phu, the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya, Kwame Nkrumah's founding of Ghana as the first modern independent African state, the Cuban Revolution under Fidel Castro, and the gradual movement towards independence by scores of former European colonies scattered throughout Asia, Africa, the Middle East, the Caribbean, and Latin America. This was the era that gave birth to the so-called third world, and I'm putting that in quotes. And few artists channeled the tensions and triumphs of this emerging post-colonial order better than Bob Marley. By using the intertwined stories and musical contributions of Bob and Damian Marley as a narrative baseline, if you will, my main concern in this morning's presentation is to focus on reggae music and other forms of so-called world music, and the concern that they've not been rigorously interrogated or effectively examined as a mode of post-colonial discourse in their own right, although infinitely and immediately more accessible than their literary counterparts. Let me explain. For instance, the collective body of written works of, by, and about people from the two-thirds world, you know, the large proportion of humans on the planet, formerly subjugated under the imperial authority of the modern West, has been dubbed post-colonial literature. Confined to neither a specific continent nor a particular language, this genre spans a vast amount of literature produced in Africa, Asia, Australia, and the Americas. Despite this far-ranging diversity, though, post-colonial written works tend to explore comparable themes: cultural and national identity, religious tensions, subjugation of one race or ethnic group by another, and other issues relating to the mixing and clashing of cultures resulting from the twin forces of globalization and creolization, a notion of cultural or racial hybridity and intermixing. Major post-colonial authors are countless, with a whole slew more coming along the way, with a whole new generation of authors and artists exploring experiences of non-Western immigrants living in Britain, the United States, and other modern Western industrialized countries. Having said all that, the problem as I see it with how academics generally approach post-colonial cultural productions is still caught up in the hegemonic mindset and technologies of power determined by the colonizers. Put simply, privileging the printed word over all other modes of human expression and communication ultimately excludes a majority of the world's subjugated peoples. Even though the primacy and preference for written prose may work in the West, the vast majority of the world's people are infinitely more receptive to the power of music to serve as not only a form of casual diversion, but also as a mode of critical discourse. And to this point, as a hybridized musical form emerging in the latter half of the 20th century, reggae combines Afro-Caribbean rhythms and instrumentation found in music such as mento and calypso with a whole gamut of African-American musical genres ranging from the spirituals, the blues, jazz, rhythm and blues, and soul influences that makes it a wonderfully rich site or case study for exploring Afro-diasporic cultural continuities. While I acknowledge that there are numerous limits and impositions affecting the creation, performance, and dissemination of music, it is even more important to recognize the conditions of possibility that music symbolizes as a power source all its own. To quote one of my favorite lyrics by Bob Marley from his song, Trenchtown Rock, "One good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain." In light of this focus, I contend that by developing a more thoroughgoing assessment of reggae music and the ways it attends to issues such as faith, in this case, Rastafari theology, and politics, using the focus of contemporary Jamaican society, as alternative means for exploring the manifold themes and issues inherent to understanding the post-colonial experience. So let me get to the nitty-gritty. As with all things, let's begin with the beginning. The musician known worldwide as Bob Marley was born on February 6, 1945, in the small village of Nine Mile in St. Anne's Parish in Jamaica as Nestor Robert Marley. His father, Norval Sinclair Marley, was a white Jamaican colonial officer whose family came from Essex, England, and was serving as a captain in the Royal Marines as well as a plantation overseer when he married Sidella Booker, an 18-year-old Afro-Jamaican woman from St. Anne's Parish. Although Marley's father provided financial support for his young wife and child, he seldom saw them because he was often away on missions and trips. In 1945, his father died of a heart attack at age 60 when Bob Marley was 10 years old. And in many ways, I'm trying to work with this here, The biographical sketch of Bob Marley's nuclear family and its dynamic could also be extrapolated to serve as a metaphorical allusion to the dysfunction and eventual demise of the British colonial regime in Jamaica. Think about it. An older white patriarch is absentee father, then deceased. Young black mother who must find a way alone in the world for herself and her offspring the best way she can. And a child of mixed racial ancestry who must find out about the world at large while also exploring the nature of the skin he's in. From my vantage point, that's the bare bones of a post-colonial literary masterpiece in the making, if I ever saw one. Marley was teased as a youth because of his mixed racial origins and faced questions about his own racial identity throughout his life. Later in life, he once reflected, "I don't have prejudice against myself. My father was a white and my mother was black. Them call me half-caste or whatever. Me don't dip on nobody's side. Me don't dip on the black man's side nor the white man's side. Me dip on God's side, the one who created me and caused me to come from black and white." Even as Marley clearly recognized his biracial ancestry and acknowledged the perceived implications it had on his claims of racial authenticity throughout his life, it was because of his spiritual beliefs as a Rasta, as well as his lived experiences, that he self-identified as a black African. While this mindset is evident in much of Marley's songbook, it is most readily apparent in songs such as Chant Down Babylon, 400 Years, Buffalo Soldier, Africa Unite, Babylon System, and Black Man Redemption. And if you haven't checked these songs out, I recommend you do. Each one is a masterpiece. But it's in these songs where he sings about the struggles of black people across the African diaspora against Western systems of imperialist domination and social oppression known collectively or euphemistically as Babylon. And I'll talk more about this later. Now, when Bob Marley was a teenager, he and Neville Bunny Livingston, later known as Bunny Wailer, grew up in the same household virtually as brothers when Marley's mother and Livingston's father formed a blended family. Marley left school at the age of 14 to make music alongside Bunny Livingston and Joe Higgs, a local singer and a devout Rastafarian. That's how Bob starts to make these connections for himself religiously. It was sometime later at a jam session with Higgs and Livingston that Marley encountered Peter McIntosh, later to be known as Peter Tosh, who shared similar musical tastes and aspirations. By 1963, Marley, Bunny Wailer, and Peter Tosh formed the nucleus of a ska and rock steady ensemble. And just to bring you up to speed, ska and rock steady were two kind of organic precursors to reggae music. And you can hear them in various iterations in contemporary music. You think about groups like The Clash or The Police, if you're familiar with those. But the idea that this band would eventually go through a series of name changes and eventually morph into the Wailers, at which point they were discovered by a noted record producer, Coxon Dowd. By 1966, after several bandmates departed from the Wailers, that left the core and classic trio of Marley, Wailer, and Tosh intact. Meanwhile, just as his musical career was hitting his stride, his personal life was also taking a turn. In terms of his marriage to Rita Anderson, later known as Rita Marley. The newlyweds soon left Jamaica and moved near his mother's adopted residence in Wilmington, Delaware, of all places, for a brief... Yeah, no reason to go to Wilmington. Okay. Ask Joe Biden. But for a brief sojourn in the United States. During his short stay in America, which Marley... used as an opportunity to make ends meet by working as, among other things, a lab assistant at DuPont, as well as a blue-collar laborer on the assembly line at a Chrysler plant. Thankfully for music lovers everywhere, he quit his day job and showed that the stint in America's industrial workforce was only temporary. Upon his eventual return to Jamaica, Marley became a member of the Rastafari movement and began wearing his trademark dreadlocks in keeping with the tenets and aesthetics of the movement. After a conflict with Dodd, Marley and his bandmates teamed up with the legendary music producer Lee Scratch Perry and his studio band, The Upsetters. Although this creative alliance lasted less than a year, it was during this short period and this kind of conducive situation in which the Wailers recorded what many people consider their finest work. Marlene Perry eventually parted ways after a dispute regarding the assignment of recording rights, but the two remained lifelong friends and eventually would work together again. The same cannot be said of the Wailers. Things seemed to be going well for the group at first. Their first album, Catch a Fire, was released in 1973 and sold well thanks to an international distribution plan with their label, Island Records. It was followed a year later by the aforementioned Burning, which included the songs Get Up, Stand Up, and I Shot the Sheriff. But it was only when British guitar legend Eric Clapton covered the version of I Shot the Sheriff and it became a runaway hit that Bob Marley's international reputation skyrocketed as well. One sure sign, though, of the band's imminent demise was when the head of Island Records began meddling with the group's internal dynamics by presenting the group to the press and the general public as, quote-unquote, Bob Marley and the Wailers, for the sake of marketing and promotion. As should be expected, the Wailers broke up in 1974 in short fashion, with each of the three main members going their own separate ways to pursue solo careers. Despite the breakup, Marley continued recording under the moniker Bob Marley and the Wailers, although he now had to assemble a whole new band. Nevertheless, after the breakthrough commercial success of their follow-up album, Natty Dread, any fears about the future viability of Bob Marley and his band were officially laid to rest. But as political turmoil began to rock the Jamaican countryside, the question soon became whether members of the band would live to enjoy their newfound celebrity status. Let me explain. In December 1976, in an attempt to ease mounting tensions between armed gunmen affiliated with the nation's two rival political parties, the People's National Party and the Jamaican Labor Party, a free concert with Bob Marley and the Wailers as the event's headliners, entitled Smile Jamaica, was organized by the Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley. A couple days before the concert occurred, a group of unknown gunmen broke into the Marley family home and attempted to murder Bob and Rita Marley, as well as Don Taylor, their manager. Both Taylor and Rita Marley were seriously injured as a result of the shooting, but eventually made full recovery. Meanwhile, Bob Marley received minor wounds in the chest and arm. It was widely suspected and speculated that the shooting was an assassination attempt because opponents felt that the show was a veiled means of using Marley's celebrity clout and street credibility to bolster Manley's electoral support. Yet, as the old saying goes, the show must go on. And so the concert proceeded, with an injured Marley performing as scheduled a scant 2 days after the murder attempt. Before a crowd of 80,000 people, the members of a local group called Zap Pow, who had no expressed religious or political affiliations or beliefs, were conscripted as Bob Marley's backup band at the festival while members of the Wailers were still in hiding, in fear for their lives. When asked why he went on stage in light of the clear and present dangers, Marley simply responded, "The people who are trying to make this world worse aren't taking a day off. How can I?" However, with political tensions and accompanying threats of violence rising in Jamaica, Marley and the Wailers were compelled to leave their beloved homeland in 1976, headed for England, where he spent 2 years in self-imposed exile. During his stay in the UK, he and his band recorded his Exodus and Kaya albums in the heart of the fading British Empire that they had repeatedly denounced as Babylon. We'll talk about this. This period in the saga of Marley as both artist and activist is pivotal. First, when one listens to the entire Exodus album, it is noteworthy for several reasons. First, with its commercial success and critical acclaim, and I'm noting Time magazine here that called Exodus the greatest album of the 20th century back in 1999, it spawned not only four hit singles, Exodus, Waiting in Vain, Jamming, and a medley slash cover of One Love, alongside a stirring rendition of Curtis Mayfield's civil rights anthem, People Get Ready. The creative output of this period is probably the most ethereal and esoteric, if you will, ghost-like in some fashions, musical work of his career in terms of his ability to actually give voice to the spiritual ache of exile and the existential yearning for home. Additionally, he and his band were able to make an indelible impact on the burgeoning punk music scene in the UK during the 1970s. This was most especially the case with the seminal British punk band The Clash, in which Marley found a kindred spirit in the singer-songwriter Joe Strummer, who, like Marley, not only loved the same music, but was also a conscientious co-worker in justice-making efforts. So impressed was Marley by the anti-racist and anti-imperialist politics of the Clash and their followers, he and the Wailers wrote a commemorative single, Reggae Punky Party. Yet despite this glimmer of hope that there were white allies ready, willing, and able to bring down Babylon, the harsh reality that there, quote-unquote, ain't no black in the Union Jack, was brought home with great force during his time in London when he was arrested and received a conviction for possession of a small quantity of marijuana. And, you know, just parenthetically, you know, being that the use of marijuana or ganja is a sacramental herb, if you will, in Rastafari theology, you know, cracking down on Bob Marley for carrying ganja is like, you know, trying to arrest the Pope for having rosary beads. I mean, you know, but we can contextualize that later. But nevertheless, you know, under the threat of further harassment based on his race, religion, and nationality in the UK, Marley was finally convinced that, be it ever so troubled, there's no place like home. In 1978, Marley returned to Jamaica and subsequently performed at another political concert, this one called the One Love Peace Concert, again in the hopes of calming the strife between the warring parties. Towards the end of the evening's performance, at Marley's behest, Michael Manley, the leader of the then-ruling left-leaning People's National Party, and his political rival, Edward Seaga, leader of the opposing hard-right Jamaican Labor Party, joined each other on stage and shook hands. This situation marked a considerable turning point for all involved. As the Jamaican government strove to fully maximize its marketability as a vacation hotspot, it decided to literally capitalize on the fame of its chief cultural export by co-opting the various aspects of Rastafarian culture, particularly reggae music and in a less visible fashion, marijuana, for tourism purposes. This is most evident in the use of Bob Marley's songs, One Love and Three Little Birds, in a long-running advertising campaign by the Jamaican Tourism Board. And I should note, once again, as a side note, what's interesting is that both of those songs were written during Marley's imposed exile, right? So ironically, Jamaica is using music that he couldn't produce in Jamaica for fear for his own life to advertise why Jamaica's a wonderful place to come to. Okay, you know, wrestle with that for a while. This period also marked a political sea change, which saw the liberal Manley regime displaced by the ultra-conservative Seaga interregnum, which would set the island nation on a decidedly troubling path in coming decades, which I'll discuss in a minute. Lastly, this is the same time that Bob Marley was diagnosed with cancerous malignancy on his right big toe, and although doctors advised him at the time to have the toe amputated, Marley adamantly refused, saying, "Rasta no abide amputation. I and I don't allow a man to be dismantled." This decision quite literally proved to be a fatal one. In order to more fully contextualize why this decision made sense to Marley at this critical juncture, it's important now to turn our attention to the Rastafari theology that was the basis of his faith. Now, to be clear, Rastafari is not a highly organized religion in any sense that would fit comfortably within a church sect typology. In fact, Rastas flatly reject any aspects or any attempts to refer to their corporate enterprise as a quote-unquote religion, preferring instead to call it a way of life. Dating back to its origins in the 1930s as a direct outgrowth of the intermixture of both Christian millennialism through the Revival Baptists and other groups and Garveyite ideology of black nationalism, the Rastafarian religious movement regarded the Ethiopian emperor Haile Selassie I, who ironically was the last monarch of the lone sovereign African state of Ethiopia, as its god incarnate. To wit, the movement's very name, Rastafari, is derived from the title and birth name of Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia from 1930 to 1947, prior to his ascendancy to the imperial throne, Rastafari Makonnen. According to the Rastafarian tradition, Haile Selassie was the 225th in an unbroken line of Ethiopian monarchs of the Divinic, dynasty. The genealogical foundation of this dynasty was reportedly founded in the 10th century BC with the birth of Menelik I, the son of Makeda, the queen of Sheba, and King Solomon, who had who was conceived during her visit to Israel. On the basis of the Ethiopian national epic, the Kebra Nagas, Rosses uplift this narrative to assert that she gave birth to Solomon's heir, and thus conclude that African people are directly linked among the children of Israel, a historical claim of origin carried forward by the Falashas, the community of Ethiopian Jews. According to Rasta teachings and biblical interpretation, biblical verses such as Psalms 2nd chapter, Psalm 68 verse 17, Psalms 87 4 and 6, Zephaniah 3 and chapter 3 verse 10, Revelations 5, 10, and various other passages all allude to or illustrate for devout Rastas the prophesying of the reign of Haile Selassie. Moreover, during his imperial coronation, Selassie was given many of the titles used in the Bible, such as King of Kings, Elect of God, Conquering Lion of the Tribe of Judah, the Author of Mankind, as just some of the nearly 40 titles and anointments bestowed upon him by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Although Rastafari theology is more often characterized and caricatured by its two most superficial features, the growing of dreadlocks worn by adherents such as Marley and followers' sacramental use of marijuana, there are several aspects of the movement that require critical attention, being representative of post-colonial faith tradition. For example, even though they have upheld a rather loose sense of Trinitarianism, particularly in the wake of Selassie's death, Rastas are prone to say that Jah, in the form of the Holy Spirit, lives in each human, and therefore they often refer to themselves as I and I. Furthermore, I and I is used instead of we, and is used in this way to emphasize the equality of all humanity as a recognition of that Holy Spirit within each of us that makes us essentially one and the same. Next, although there's been a fair amount of attention paid to Marcus Garvey's contribution to the origins of Rastafari as its foremost prophet of Jah, a greater understanding of Black faith and culture in the African diaspora would benefit from a deeper engagement with Marcus Garvey's sustained efforts during his lifetime to merge politics and religion with his vision of Pan-Africanism in overt ways to inform post-colonial conceptions of race, faith, and politics. So rather than thinking that Garvey was just some oddball, theorist or advocate of Black nationalism, he's actually integral. He's actually indispensable to the development of the movement and comparable movements throughout the Caribbean or throughout the African diaspora. Next, I think we must engage in a thoroughgoing assessment of how Rastafari offers a major critique of conventional notions of Christology, ecclesiology, soteriology, and even eschatology, and its inability to speak theological truths to their specific post-colonial plight. To wit, we must evaluate Rastafari theology in light of the fact that Rastas themselves avowedly reject the divine messianic nature of Jesus Christ, renounce the Christian church as a corporate enterprise of God's people at work in the world, and repudiate a model of salvation emanating from the divine rather than the human means. These are all points that are raised by Bob Marley's song, Get Up, Stand Up. Viewed from a perspective steeped in our modern sensibilities, and I'm taking on the eschatological concern here, if one's heaven is located on the physical map, meaning that it is literally possible to get there, a plane trip or some such, a boat ride to Ethiopia in the case of Rastafarians, what would prevent a faithful believer from doing everything possible to get there? To me, in order to pursue the innermost truths of Rastafari theology itself, it is incumbent on the observer or researcher to develop a systematic methodology that can explain African-derived faith traditions and spirituality in ways that assess adherence in own terms and own systems of belief, rather than imposing our own external kind of mandates or prejudices as a default mechanism. And I'll just move along here for the sake of time. Lastly, it's important to consider how in many ways the repudiation of many African-centered religions going back from slave religions such as Obeah and Kumana, as well as the more modern marginalized movements such as the Revival Baptist and the Rastafarian movements by middle class and elite Jamaicans of our time, who emerged largely as an outgrowth of black bourgeois values, either in actuality or in aspiration, as being a representation of what the historian Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham refers to as a politics of respectability. I think it is no small coincidence that the political, cultural, and moral landscape of Jamaica shifted towards a more conservative and materialistic extreme that followed a form of what I call self-delusional nihilism, borrowing from Cornel West here. While the Jamaican government was attempting to ramp up its attractiveness as a vacationer's island paradise in order to maximize its burgeoning tourism industry, the government and broader organs of civil society failed to acknowledge the growing poverty, violence, and sense of criminality that was becoming all too commonplace due to a society being permeated by the laissez-faire logic of the market gone wild. There has been relatively little recognition of the middle class concessions to materialist concerns and abandonment of the liberationist impulse of the post-colonial era of Jamaican history, a moment I clearly see epitomized by the political ascendancy of Edward Seaga, leader of the conservative Jamaican Labor Party since 1974 and Jamaican Prime Minister between 1980 and 1989. And it's also important to note that a protege of his, Bruce Golding, is now the Labor Party's ruling member and Prime Minister of Jamaica. So we're going to see a return to the bad old days, I believe. In light of this, the Seaga years in Jamaican politics coincided with the Reagan presidency here in the U.S., as well as the premiership of Margaret Thatcher in the U.K. to form an ultra-conservative troika, if you will, that would have a crippling effect on politics, economics, and culture, not only in Jamaican society, but also throughout the larger Caribbean and Latin American context that's still being felt today. This was the post-colonial milieu that shapes the substance and structure of Damian Marley's song, Welcome to Jamrock, which I'm playing right now. Born in July 21st, 1978, Damian Robert Nesta, quote-unquote, Junior Gong Marley, was only 2 years old when his father, Bob Marley, died. As the only child born to an extramarital affair between Marley and the former Miss World 1976, Cindy Breakspear, Damian's nickname, Junior Gong, is derived from his father's nickname, Tough Gong. Like most of his family, Damian Marley has had a full-time career in the music industry, professionally performing as a recording artist since the age of 13, as a vocalist among other in other settings, as a vocalist for a group called the Shepherds. However, unlike his 10 paternal siblings, rather than following directly in his father's footsteps by performing the more traditional style of reggae known as culture, Damian Marley's musical specialty is toasting in a dance hall setting. For those who are unaware, toasting, also known as chatting, is a Jamaican vocal technique prevalent in dance hall, which is akin to rapping within hip-hop in that the act of talking or chanting, usually in a melodious monotone, over a rhythm track or breakbeat played by a DJ in order to motivate the crowd to keep dancing and partying. This is a narrative poetic style or lyrical exhortation over a drum beat. The Shepherds had a fair amount of success, but eventually dissolved and left Marley out on his own. But it's at this point, he takes up DJing, producing, and he takes his own path. With Marley's next release, School Controversy, in 1995, he was featured as the spokesperson for a campaign known as Positively Reggae. And the proceeds of that song going to Jamaica's Leaf of Life Foundation, an organization that assists children who are HIV positive. Although he was just a teenager himself, Marley was selected to be the spokesperson, and it exposed him to the international press as well as the record-buying public in a more positive light, and especially in spite of his earlier forays into the world of slackness, and I'll try to touch on that if time permits. This development coincided with the ascendancy of musical acts such as Buju Bantan, one of the best Jamaican dancehall performers since the mid-1990s, and also witnessed the turn in Damian Marley, as well as Buju Bantan's personal and professional transformation towards a positive synergy of music, militancy, and mystical meditation in terms of fomenting a sort of danceable revolution that restores the gravitas and grandiose nature of reggae that had been despoiled by the likes of folks like Shabba Ranks or Sean Paul, you know, who were operating in a more banal and counterproductive kind of sexualized form of music known as slackness. Despite his innate talent, charisma, and artistry, though, somebody like Bantan lacked the one thing that nobody else could give him, the Marley birthright. The same year Damian performed at select dates on then reigning king of dancehall music Shabba Ranks' World Unity Tour. Consequently, Damian was reconnected with his family in a number of ways. He went on tour with his brother Julian and performed at Reggae Sunsplash and Sunfest. And also, just after his solo debut, he also began to reconnect with his brother, Steven, an older brother who was already in the music business, and divided his time between Kingston, Jamaica, and Miami, Florida. I think it's this kind of reconnection, both in terms of his spiritual roots as well as to his biological or familial roots, that suddenly now ramped up the quality as well as the kind of concerns that Damian Marley was going to pour into his third album, Welcome to Jamrock. Now, both in terms of the song that you just heard as well as the album, they both marked a quantum leap for Damian Marley in both his creative output and his critical outlook. The rhythm track, if you could catch it, was based on Get Up Stand Up, and it was a remaking, a reworking of that song, and trying to speak to the conditions of Jamaica right now. The violence, the abnegation of state or police authority, well, the abuse of police authority, and the abnegation of state responsibility to its citizenry. The fact that everything looks pretty, but really, it's unpleasant. Throughout Welcome to Jamrock, both the song and the album, Damian Marley focuses on poverty and politics in the 21st century Jamaican context with laser-like intensity. In spite of the jarring sonic backdrop and the gritty lyrical content built on the solid foundation of his father's international hit Get Up Stand Up, Damian Marley has stated on more than one occasion that Welcome to Jamrock is really about hope and that he wants to continue to spread positivity throughout his musical career. And subsequently, the song and the album went on to not only win a Grammy for Best Reggae Album, but also Best Urban and Alternative Performance, a notable accomplishment because his father never received a Grammy. Lastly, in a way to kind of wrap up, currently Damian Marley is in the studio with, of all people, the hip-hop artist Nas, working on a collaborative album they're entitling Distant Relatives, slated to be released in late April of this year. And that album title is inspired both by their friendship in trying to cross the boundaries of the Black Atlantic, as well as their shared commitment to Pan-Africanism, a common thread throughout that self-named album. As a way of concluding, I want to play this song that I found in all of all places, iTunes, called Stand Up Jamrock, which is actually a mashup of the father and son songs reinvented and put together. And what I'm trying to suggest, and hopefully we have a minute or two for questions, the idea that we need a reinfusion of energies of the older and the younger generation to remake and reinvent Jamaican society and culture, but ultimately world society and culture, in a way so that you could still have the prophetic fire, the passion of what you see in Bob Marley, but also recognize that the youth have something to say, that the youth have something to contribute. And rather than saying that the movement and the music of the youth is irrelevant or, you know, it's a passing fad, see the legitimacy therein and recognize that that there can be a happy synergy of the two. So without further ado, advertising moment, when I was wrestling with and dealing with this issue of mashup, you know, which has now entered the lexicon in a positive way. As a child growing up, as a Jamaican, first generation Jamaican American, when we used the word mashup, it was usually the most derogatory or messed up statement you can make about somebody. Look on him now, how him live, you know, and mash up now, right? You know, you are not praising somebody by saying that, you know, they or what they did was mash up. But I think in very much this mode of wrestling with the post-colonial reality, the idea that, you know, you're inverting or you know, subversively rearranging notions, where something that once seemed like a mess, just a hot mess on a cold day, can now be something, a thing of beauty. That could be eternal. And even if you see this this actual mashup of the two songs, Get Up, Stand Up and Jam Rock, right, even the ghostly kind of thread that Bob Marley's voice casts upon the production, you know, I mean, it's like something out of Shakespeare, you know, the ghost of Hamlet's father coming through to, you know, try to guide him in the direction he needs to go. But then once again, you know, Damian Marley being insistent and insurgent in his way, you know, the notion that Jam Rock, this is our reality now. So To wrestle with this notion and hoping that, as the paper suggests, that the Jam Rock's generation will stand up, that it will stand up against a government that's extremely negative and running in a course that is against the will and the hopes of the people. Thank you. I think we have 30 seconds or however long for questions. If there's any questions, I'll gladly take them. I thank you for your patience and perseverance. Okay, we got
two questions real quick.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
First question, if you could speak to the year that I guess slackness begins to take to height to some degree. And then secondly, would you say that slackness and the way in which it becomes the commodity of Jamaica, would compare that with what we began to see in hip-hop culture in the late 80s going towards the early 90s as it pertains to the selling of gangster rap or the commodification of black suffering? And is there any comparison in that as it pertains to Jamaican artists maybe seeing what's taking place in America and then following suit?
Okay. I think two wonderful questions by Damian Durr, an excellent student, so I'll receive them as such. And I think they're well-informed because, as I try to suggest, even in the genesis of reggae music, there was always, what's going on here in the ground in the Jamaican context, but it's always pulling from international and global influences and sources, especially looking to the global north in terms of the United States. So what you have to understand is, in this kind of, you know, quirky kind of hodgepodge of musical culture, some of the most immediately accessible music stations, for instance, by radio, were coming from places like Florida. You could even get as far out as Alabama and radio stations from Louisiana, like New Orleans. So which is literally a gumbo kind of situation. So you would get country music. There's a huge country and western fascination on the Jamaican Islands. I'm waiting to dig into that deeper. Obviously, as I mentioned, black music just runs rampant. But also this idea that it runs on parallel lines. They're doing their own thing, but they're always with an eye and an ear to what's happening in the States. So you're exactly right, Damien, that the idea that slackness begins to emerge and evolve around the same time that gangster rap does in the U.S. So right around late 80s, early 90s. And also for, I think, the same reasons, the issues of titillation, the issues of, right, if you talk about sex and violence and cash and all the things that cash begets, you know, people, especially those folks who are on the desperate side of poverty, right, they want to get with that. But then also for the vacationers, for the tourists, for the folks who just want to, you know, slum it, you know, for a little bit, not Slumdog Millionaire, but, you know, who just want to dabble in this kind of embodied, you know, kind of reality, right? They live vicariously through it. So you have that twofold kind of situation. And then when you get somebody like a Shabba Ranks, who, as I said, was the reigning king of, you know, slackness and dancehall, right, Shabba? Right, when you get him as a kind of poster child for the movement, his videos were literally mimicking the kind of flashy kind of hip-hop videos of the era, right? Including the video Vixens and all that kind of stuff. So there was very much, and also keep in the back of your mind, and I tried to suggest this in the paper, the constant pushing and nudging of the record industry, right? And it's the same kind of global arm of the record industry that wanted to push and prod, you know, Bob Marley out in front of the Wailers. Is the same kind of mentality that's poking and prodding a more radical form of reggae to be watered down or diverted and diluted into, you know, this kind of slackness and this kind of, more, as I say, counterproductive musical form. All right, so I hope I got to that question. Yes, I saw you. True that. Okay. Respect. Okay.
But you keep saying slackness, which I think is an elitist critique of dancehall music.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I guess, one set of people articulating their concern and really a struggle over Jamaican identity, whereas which kind of music can accurately represent mm-hmm. Jamaica as a nation, Jamaica as a people that. I know, kind of
out of many one,
like and things like that. But could you, beyond that, could you say a little bit about the effects of this transition to dancehall and this new slackness, as you call it?
Define slackness.
Right.
I guess I'm a little bit concerned or I'm curious as to what slackness is defined as before we can even speak on it.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, in addition to that, to also see how this kind of a move to slackness affected the activism that was the much subtler reggae and this new brashness that was dancehall.
Okay. And Dr. Mike, can I add to that? I was thinking of the Buju Banta, and then mm-hmm. you started to make the transition to that. Thinking about the song Pull It Up,
mm-hmm.
and how the lyrics talk about without the dance hall, what we would do reggae music does.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Buju Banta coming from this social consciousness, critiquing socio-political structures and the like
mm-hmm.
within the Jamaican context. But, like, I mean, all of that being one.
Yeah.
And so just tag that on to that.
Okay. And do it in 30 seconds. Okay. No, I appreciate both questions or the series of questions. And first I want to clarify, I made no intention to simply mask, well, first of all, I give all respect to dancehall and understand that the sound systems were the source of hip-hop and were the original kind of wellspring from which, you know, many of the folks in New York and you know, we could even look to the UK in terms of Brixton and elsewhere, how they developed their hip-hop styles, or in the UK, the dub styles. So, you know, enough respect on that. Second, I will use an analogous scenario here, that much like gangster rap becomes like the kind of face of hip-hop in U.S. Critiques, I'll say that foremost, of hip-hop music, slackness becomes the kind of superficial or scapegoat, if you will, to borrow the René Girard kind of concern, the scapegoat for anything that's ailing Jamaican music, particularly dancehall. But what I'm referring to in terms of slackness, as I see it, is it's a kind of party music, but it's invariably misogynistic, materialistic in its content, and really, for me, now granted, it can just be a matter of taste, it can be a matter of perspective, but the idea that when it becomes the kind of go-to music, the kind of definitive party music, if you will, of the people, it has a place and it has a purpose. We understand that. I wrestle with the historian Robin Kelly in our moral philosophy of black popular culture class. We've been wrestling with some of these issues. And he talks about the notion that irreverence has always been a part of black popular cultural production. So we have to wrestle with that tension of, okay, well, what does it mean to have this kind of expression of sexuality or violence, and that it is part of the black vernacular, whether you're talking about it in the American South, whether you're talking about that in St. Anne's or St. Catherine's Parish, like, what does this mean? You know, what also happens when it becomes morphed into something like reggaeton in the Puerto Rican context, right? So that's my brief, but I hope substantial definition of slackness as I see it. Now, to Omar's question about Buju Banton and trying to bridge the gap here, I marvel at the kind of transformation that Buju has made in his career and in his life, both in terms of becoming more spiritual in his outlook and in his performance, also having a broader world vision, a broader historical vision, right? Because when he came out, he was being, you know, set, I think, in a track very much like a Shava Ranks. And when you fashion a career like that, in that mode, for instance, many folks might not even remember who Shava was, except for, you know, a stray pop cultural reference, right? What happens when we have industries and cultural kind of appetites or tastes that don't build artists or create a context for artists to flourish and to be fully who they will or ought to be, right? Another issue that I have with Buju Banton and other performers, there was a dust up a few years ago that still might be lingering in terms of folks going back into his songbook, into his songwriting career, and looking earlier in his career when he laid down some very homophobic statements, you know, as well as his misogynistic work. Well, how do you wrestle with the person he is now versus, you know, portraits of him as an artist, as a young man, to quote James Joyce, right? Right? Can he have a kind of a redemption, if you will, right? And also, now that he's trying to, you know, as we were talking to Christian idiom, you know, sin no more, you know, get up, you know, dust himself off and go forth and sin no more. How does that emulate a possibility for Jamaican life and politics, wherein you have the prime minister, this fellow Bruce Gordon with the Jamaican Labor Party, who's espousing this very hardline homophobic rhetoric, who's saying that, you know, I don't want anybody I even suspect or know of as a homosexual to serve in my cabinet. Now, I think this serves a twofold purpose, right? Not only does it try to obviously, you know, set up a persecution narrative, a scapegoating method for gays and lesbians within the context of Jamaica, but it also serves as a kind of straw man tactic, if you will, to try and lump social problems on a particular group of folk in the island and not look at the deficiency of the JLP's own political policies. Because they ran on a platform of trying to undermine the legacy of people like a Michael Manley, Alexander Bustamante, and others, you know, a more liberal, left-leaning politic with a more right-wing politic, right? Well, if they can't, you know, fight the forces of the IMF more successfully, police the streets more successfully, develop jobs and economic prosperity more successfully, let's lump this concern on the masses of folk in terms of, you know, give them something to fear or give them somebody to hate. That's not us, right? Now, in terms of Buju, I think his contributions to dance hall, both in the past and now, are just, I think, you know, the sky's the limit with somebody like him. But what becomes interesting, and I say this also about Damian Marley, back to the matter at hand, is we need to stop focusing on an art that's simply descriptive, but now we have to wrestle with art that's going to be transformative, right? So, for instance, the lack of female voices. There are women in the dance hall and in culture and other forms of Jamaican music. I'm thinking about Sister Carol here. I'm thinking of Rita Marley, of course. I'm thinking of, you know, back in the day there was Patra, and, you know, there was some sexual politics that had to be wrestled with her. But how do you further instill a sense of gender equity within this kind of musical sphere? And then also, how does that represent the life of the larger body? If y'all are willing, I'm ready. Or if you got to go, I understand that too. Yes, my friend.
The mashup piece, I was thinking about it in terms of what I was talking about before. There's a kind of, what I heard you saying is there's an archival piece in it that picks up, you know, Bob Marley's work. And then there's another piece which is more inventive and sort of, so in a sense there's a kind of using past history to construct a kind of new counter history.
Sure, yeah.
Within the music. But I'm trying to figure out, what's the power of this past work? Why not just move on? Why go back and pick up, you know, Bob Marley stuff? I mean, what kind of power are we talking about? Why go back and pick up, you know, old breakbeat, you know, DJ's
sure,
going,
yeah, yeah,
you know, and do all this crate digging, mm-hmm, rummaging around for old breaks and stuff? Why, you know, I'm trying to get my hands on it. I mean, what's the power of past history in constructing counter history? How does that work? Is it just nice, or I want to associate myself with something good from the past, or is there some real power here?
Well, and I thank you for the question, John. I can address this in a threefold fashion. First, there is this kind of concern that comes out of post-colonial discourse. I'm thinking here in terms of Homi Bhabha, the post-colonial theorist who talks about this issue of memory, and that memory is this kind of contested terrain. It's a hard terrain, but it's also sometimes dangerous but necessary, especially when you're confronting this issue of race, when you're confronting this issue of the powers of this world, and this idea that we have to remember that there are powers, you use the kind of Pauline injunction of powers and principalities, that there are powers in place in this world that need to be wrestled with, structures that have to be confronted. And just because the names or the faces might change, they don't go away, they don't fade away. So for instance, even to talk about a quote post-colonial reality is really still the same old colonial concern, just with, you know, now you've got maybe ExxonMobil or Halliburton attached to it rather than just simply saying, you know, the United States Empire or the British Empire, right, you know. So memory, the endurance of memory, the fact that memory is a chain that connects the past to the present and ultimately to the future. Also, I'm wrestling here with another theorist by the name of Garrity Spivak, who in her classic statement, you know, she asked the question, can the subaltern speak? Well, in that question, there's embedded two other kind of deeper concerns, you know, especially when it's about the oppressed talking to the oppressor, which is A, should the subaltern speak? Should the oppressed have, you know, the room and opportunity to speak? And more importantly, and this is the thing that's treacherous, can the subaltern think, right? The idea that this notion of mashup and the kind of excavation, the kind of heavy lifting and, you know, getting your hands dirty and doing that kind of deep deep digging, if you will, you know, keeping that archaeological metaphor running. Right. It's physical labor, it's time intensive, but it's also thoughtful work. It's critical work, right? It means that you have to know what to keep and what to throw away, or what to save for another day, right? And that you have to be strategic about it. This is all kind of cognitive work. It's all, you know, kind of neck up concerns that, unfortunately, in a generation, in an era that wanted to kind of overlook the possibility that the darker nations of the world had something to contribute to the global north, to, you know, the industrialized modern West, that these folk, the subaltern, could actually beat the West at its own game, so to speak, could actually make something out of nothing, if we want to use the old Black Christian idiom. And lastly, and I think this is the power, especially in terms of the mashup that I played for you today, the idea that, and tracing back to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, but this is a notion that's prevalent in many African traditional societies, this notion of the ancestors are always with us. And if we speak of them, if we think of them, if we regard them as here but not here, right, that, you know, there's power in their presence in our midst. So that rather than just simply, you know, tucking them away as museum pieces or you know, the loved ones of a bygone era, but actually knowing that you can draw power and connection to them in a very present fashion, right, that in and of itself bespeaks a kind of strength in numbers, if you will. For instance, and I'll stop on this note, because of the kind of technologies of late modernity, I always get tripped out and blown away that I can listen to a live recording of a dead person. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, just by, I mean, it's simple wordplay, but it blows my mind repeatedly. And the fact that, you know, I can hear a live recording of a Billie Holiday or Nina Simone. I can hear, you know, Sam Cooke or Marvin Gaye, and they're still as vibrant to me now as they were then. I can't touch them in the physical essence, but I know that somehow the power of what they're trying to invoke, heartache or you know, euphoria, is still with me. So to me, that's the power of the mashup in this regard, that especially for a generation like Damian Marley in Jamaica, but many of the hip-hop artists in our own midst who for years didn't have access to musical instruments or musical education, but still felt the yearning and need to make music and use the means at their disposal to do so. And in fact, as I said before, not only did they master those arts, but then those arts got mimicked by advertising agencies, multinational corporations. You know, now to imagine the kind of pastiche work that, you know, for instance, you watch a Quentin Tarantino movie, right? He's just totally jacked, you know, the whole notion of sampling and making soundtracks.
Okay. But it's different than appropriation, right? I mean, isn't part of the sacrality of Black popular culture is that performance becomes proclamation in such a way that the reason why you have remixing, mashup, and the others is not just appropriation or hijacking, but you can clearly tell, like how Elvis does it, right, with Black music, or how the Rolling Stones or the Beatles did it with Black rock and roll, right? Or wouldn't mashup be the call and the response, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the same way you don't have scholarship unless you can substantiate your claims. Mm-hmm. Is not mashup saying, I'm not saying anything that's worth the performance, that's worth your time, if it's not proclaiming something? You don't know if I'm proclaiming the truth unless the ancestors, unless it's, so it's the response to the call of that memory and the life.
And I thank you for this, Dr. Floyd Thomas. The the idea that If you wanted to dress it up in academic garb, you know, this notion of a Hegelian discourse, that, you know, there's a thesis asserted by Marley's original Get Up, Stand Up. There's an automatic kind of counter response or counter narrative dropped by his son some 20, 30 years later in terms of Welcome to Jamrock. And then the synthesis that brings it all together, that makes something hopefully more constructive, the constructive hope that I'm attending to, which is the, you know, get a or stand up jam rock. This notion that, you know, especially if we think about it in, you know, kind of sacred Black culture, the idea that call and response has always been something that we've prided ourselves on, but we've we've kind of, in some regards, made it mechanical or formulaic, mm-hmm. right, and not critical, you know, not really participatory in the way that it has greater potential for being, more democratic with a small d, if you will, right? About what happens if you really were to engage the sermonic moment or the, if you really to honestly, like for instance, if the choir does hit a couple of sour notes or whatever, really say, well, you know, instead of trying to push them through, you know, you said, well, just sit down. Y'all are, you know, y'all just tied and through.
Right. Which is why preachers now beg for the amen.
There you go. Right. There you go. You know, right, you know, look to the lights. Okay. Okay. All right. So, you know, what you're wrestling with here, though, is using the technologies of power, using the technologies of the time to have those dialogues, especially think about this narrative, and I wasn't being facetious about this. This idea, in other realms of popular culture, you see similar things happen, for instance, most famously with Nat King Cole and Natalie Cole singing Unforgettable, right? And that was a very nice and, you know, kind of warm and cuddly way of doing that. But think about this. Now with a level of political insurgency attached to it, right? A father and son who never met in physical terms, right? Who never, you know, the son was haunted literally by the ghost of the father, as with many famous children and their parents, right? Haunted by the ghost, and also used the famous parent somehow as a measuring stick or as a mile marker of how far they are to achieving something or how far from it. They actually are in reality. So the idea that for this possibility, and this wasn't done in Damian Marley or Stephen Marley or Ziggy Marley or any of the other Marley children's sound lab. This was an independent producer doing this. But the idea that someone thought enough of the two voices, the two possibilities to bring them together in this fashion and to see that they were potent with possibility, I find that as something to glean great insights from. Well, thank you. Thank you all.